The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Hyundai. Now offering 5 years free servicing on every new 142 Hyundai, Ireland's fastest growing car brand.
Let me introduce you to our panel. We're joined by Mairead McGuinness, the Fine Gael MEP and recently elected Vice President of the European Parliament. So congratulations, Mairead.
Thank you, Anya.
What does a Vice President do?
I suppose, in a word, a bit more than I do now, because I'll be running the debates in the chamber. That's the most visible part of the job. But we're also involved in some of the very deep politics around legislation, conciliation committees, and an interesting one, I think, relationships with national parliaments, because there's a real sense in which Europe needs to connect better with member states.
So it's a pretty important person.
Well, no, it makes me busier and hopefully more effective.
Also with us, the Sinn Féin TD, Piers Doherty. It's your birthday today, Piers.
It is.
Brett O'Hanagwitz. And thank you very much for joining us. I hope the cake is made at home, is it?
I hope so. I'm sure it would be here.
If we'd known, we'd have had a cake.
But we didn't know until
he just walked in the door. John Fitzgerald, ESRI economist, Cathy Sheridan of the Irish Times, and Mick Rafferty, community activist and Croke Park local. And that very much is the story of the moment. Have a listen to this.
If tomorrow never comes, wish you know how much I love.
And that's the story everybody's talking about this weekend. Let's go straight to the man of the moment. He's kind of like Ireland's answer to Ghostbusters, really. Kieran Mulvey, good morning to you.
Good morning, Anya.
Well, we heard you on Friday, and after all the chaos and the backwards and forwards and ultimatums and decisions that can't be reversed, your proposal, because you were the mediator in all of this, your proposal of the five concerts going ahead in return for a total ban next year, how is that travelling?
Well, I've spent the weekend, myself and the Lord Mayor of Dublin, Christy Burke, have been in constant contact with trying to discuss and see can some solution be brought to this situation and the impasse in it at the moment. So we're still working on that together with the parties to see if some amicable solution can be reached and that can be put in place. Now, there's a lot of difficulties around that, Anya, not least of which we have a planning and development law that doesn't allow for any appeal to anybody in regard to the decision of the city manager, whether that's a good or a bad thing that was passed in a particular circumstances. But it is a feature of the situation that this is caught in a very strict planning process, a very strict licensing process that doesn't allow now, might have allowed in the process itself, but certainly doesn't allow now for much flexibility, if any.
So if Owen Keegan, even if Owen Keegan wanted to change his decision, if you were able to go to Owen Keegan and say, here I have a deal on the table and everyone's agreed to it and everyone's signed up to it, is Owen Keegan able to change his decision legally?
I'd say there's probably a difficulty around it legally, if he's in a position to do that, from what I understand of Section 239 of the planning law. But we have to be creative too, because this is an issue of some national, if not international, interest, to which there's a considerable amount of finances and agitation at stake and various interests, and all interests, and some of it varying and contradictory with the process of legal action in the background. But, you know, we have to try and see, can the matter be resolved? We're not going to resolve it to everybody's satisfaction, but can we assist the maximum amount of people who have an interest, a genuine vested interest in this, see a solution?
Yeah, and it is one of the difficult, because I know I heard you on Friday talk, you know, with great sympathy about the residents' justifiable concerns. We've already had somebody who lives close to Marley Park on the phone saying, you know, they've had 8 concerts to deal with, and they're saying more power to the Croke Park residents. So you do have sympathy for them, but there does appear to be quite a number of groups. Does that make your job of sorting this out more difficult?
Well, I think it's an issue I addressed in the report I made. I feel my report addressed an enormous amount of the issues raised by the residents, including a proposal to register my report in a possible agreement with Dublin City Council Planning Department. So a lot of the issues they raised around antisocial behaviour, parking, overuse of Croke Park. I was limiting Croke Park to 3 concerts a year and some mitigation in 2015 and 16. And obviously some regeneration projects in the area that badly need it. But the difficulty is that you don't really have in the normal sense of the term, and it's understandable, representative organizations that have mandates specifically from the areas they represent. And as that is evident now in the situation whereby a new group of residents have emerged, they're collecting, as I understand, hundreds if not thousands of signatures demanding that the Croke Park concerts go ahead. And then you have some individuals there who are not even resident in the area, run a handball club, and who are threatening all kinds of legal action regarded, even though they're not, some of them aren't even resident in the area. So, you know, you get to a stage like during the process, who represents whom? And I'm normally involved in industrial relations, and I appreciate it different. But when you face across the table of a company or union representatives with the union officials and shop stewards, you know precisely the process you're in. But in this process I was involved in, like I was meeting different groups of residents over three or four occasions, and they had varying considerations, most of which I believe I addressed reasonably to their satisfaction. And the issue of the Garth Brooks concerts, obviously from the very beginning, was being threatened with litigation. Mm-hmm. And once I hear the word of people going down to the four gold mines, I push back a bit. I don't want to be involved in that process.
Can I ask you about one thing here, Ciara, which seems curious? There seems to have been, you know, the promoters process going on, the city council process going on, the legal and planning, and at the same time you're doing mediation. And there doesn't seem to have been much overlap between these various processes, which seems kind of curious.
Well, I think the extraordinary thing about the licensing process, and it's something I've been on an extremely fast learning curve, an extraordinary situation in this country, that you can advertise events, not just concerts, events. Advertise them, sell the tickets, obviously subject to license. Then you apply to the licensing authority, which is usually the local authority, and they can make a decision, good, bad, or indifferent. Up to now, as my understanding is, 99% of these licenses have been granted. This is the first time it hasn't happened. But the problem about not happening now, it's slightly different to a concert in Marley Park, or with due respect, a concert that might be in a locality around an event. This is an international concert of extraordinary dimensions, with an extraordinary worldwide number of tickets sold. And here we are at the last minute, 3 weeks before it's to take place, with a situation that has caused uproar, mayhem, disagreement, discord, threats of legal action, threats for a review. Could we not look at this again? The artist himself saying, if I don't get the five concerts, I'm not coming. The promoter saying he's having difficulty, can't get an alternative event. And look, my view is all these suggestions around alternative events, anybody who knows the process knows that can't happen within the time frame we're talking about. So I would suggest that there has to be a licensing process gone through for every other event, location that would be proposed.
Okay.
So we'd be back with the same problem.
I want to ask you two final questions. Are you getting the cooperation you want from all the parties? And could this one defeat you?
Well, look, I'm just trying to do my best in the interests of everybody that's involved. Whether I succeed or not is not the issue. The issue here is that you make an effort, you don't let it go by and do nothing, sit on your rear, so to speak, and let it happen. Some effort has to be made to see can some resolution be found to this within the next 24, 48 hours, probably more 24 than 48, and we'll all make our best endeavours. I'm getting cooperation from some. Others don't seem to be as creative as I would like them to be.
Would that be on the official side or on the human side?
Ah, look, I think everybody is explaining and defending their patch. And nobody wants to be wrong-footed on this. So it's not really, I wouldn't go through it apportioning blame. It's not the time for blame. It's the time for solution. Putting heads together and say, look, we have a problem. can we resolve it, and can we make sure in future this will not happen again, and that the residents around Croke Park get a year off concerts where they don't have to put up with the inconvenience that they've had to put up with in the past.
Well, look, you're very good to give us some time this Sunday morning. I appreciate that, Kieran, because I know you've rather a lot on. Good luck. Kieran Mulvey there. Mick, what do you make of all of this? You've got Kieran Mulvey's report in your bag, and you're a Croke Park resident.
Well, I feel a bit like Sarah Palin. You know, I know everything about it because I can see Croke Park from my bedroom. But to just give me a moment to try to put this in context, you know. Can anybody remember what the first concert was in that took place in Croke Park? Can anybody remember?
You too?
No, I'll give you a little clue. Sweet Caroline.
Neil
Diamond. 1984, when Pierce here was 3 years of age.
Not that young. Seven.
No, but the point I just want to make, that Kieran is indicating there the time, you know, that this process that he undertook started in February. And the report was just issued last week. And within a week, the council made this decision. So I think the report is brilliant. I mean, I think the report covers not just the issue of Croke Park as such, but it also covers the regeneration issues in and around Croke
Park.
But
why were the council making this decision when that report was coming out? Why is this all happening in one week?
The mediation was commissioned by Croke Park, not by the council. And they weren't parallel sort of...
lay your cards on the table. Do you want Garth's concerts to go ahead or not?
Just let me finish.
This is
finish.
The test here, Mick.
This is the when the new Croke Park, you know, was starting developing in the 90s, they were given planning permission for 3 concerts. This year already they had One Direction. And then they went and they...
Well, 3 One Directions.
3 One Direction concerts, plus a special event. Then those tickets went out for the Garth Brooks thing, and it snowballed. So it went from 2 concerts down to 5. Now, that's the context. Some of the residents feel that over that 30 years, Croke Park are not to be trusted under any circumstances. Now, we had a meeting last week at which I gave, and I had to go up to Croke Park to get the report. It hasn't been widely distributed. I mean, I had to go up and photocopy the relevant pages. And our feeling was, let me... You see, it's not a homogeneous
community.
So you're
in favour?
Well, let me qualify that. I'm in favour of the recommendations in the report, which said that it would be unfair to people who bought...
So you're in favour of the Mulvey Compromise, would
I'm
that
in
be
favour of
say?
The Mulvey Compromise, and particularly... I think that it's a good foundation to begin to look. He uses a phrase in the report to say that the GAA has found its corporate responsibility. You must remember, the GAA, the Croke Park, it's 2 companies. One is the Gaelic Association, which is concerned with matches, and the community spirit all around the country, of which a lot of our identity springs from. The other is a company whose sole purpose is to make money. And that's largely what the locals were dealing with. A company who would say, we'll consult with you, but that doesn't necessarily mean we'll do what you ask. So there's a lot of mistrust there. I think the basis of trust lies in this. And I would appeal to the city manager to reconsider his decision in the light of the very deep, detailed
But then there's the question about whether he actually can. Presumably, Pierce Doherty, not just your birthday, but I think somebody in your family might have tickets for Garth Brooks. So presumably you want the concert to go ahead.
Yeah, I do.
All 5 of them.
Yeah, the party have made a very clear position. We called for Kieran Mulvey to act as mediator. We welcomed his report when it came out. We believe it's been a disaster from day one, and Croke Park, the promoter, Garth Brooks himself, are all responsible for the mess that we're
and
involved in.
And listening to Kieran Mulvey there, it sounds as if it's a tiny bit in the balance this weekend, all right?
It is, and, you know, like, if you listen to Garth Brooks, it's basically 5 concerts or none, so it's even those who may have tickets for Friday, Saturday and Sunday, there may be no concerts to attend on those events.
What day are your tickets for?
Mine's are for Friday. But the key thing and the key position that we're taking here is that there is a mess made of this. What is the best position that we can actually, how do we, what do we do with the mess that's created? And our our view is, taking everything in the round and listening to the concerns of some of the residents there, because as has been said, many of the residents want the concerts to go ahead, is that all five concerts should go ahead. And that's why we're bringing forward an emergency motion to Dublin City Council tomorrow. We hope that it will get unanimous support of the councillors and put pressure on the CEO of the council to actually revisit his recommendations.
I don't think the councillors have any function in the matter.
But you heard Kieran Mulvey there, Mairead, talking about the four gold mines. And I mean, this, you know, anyone, because the law appears to be such a mess in all of this, or at least it's got so particular in all of this, it would be open to anyone to challenge any deal that was reached. And God knows where that would lead us.
Absolutely. I mean, Kieran Mulvey is very unemotional commentator, and I felt even within his attempt to be that this morning a sense of frustration. It is a mess. It's a terrible mess. My office has an interest as well in this, let me put it that way, around tickets, and this has caused awful upset from those, and remember, it's people who've bought them for gifts and all sorts of things, so there's huge kind of upset about this. It's interesting that the Sunday Independent has two journalists who both live in the shadows of Croke Park. One of them has a headline, which is Carol Hunt saying, Dublin Council has stood up for the little people. And her colleague, Louise Kelly, says, residents' action has left our global reputation in shreds. So within the newspaper, there are two different views. If it's going to go ahead, there has to be a compromise. I wish Garth Brooks hadn't said, it's all or nothing. It's like a line of a song. I think it would have been easier.
Well, he said it would be like choosing between children, but choosing which night but he to cancel.
I think if you're going to,
I think it would have been easier had he said that in his head and kept it there, but tried to work for a compromise. I hope that the concerts go ahead. I know there are people who around the area who live there who hope they don't go ahead. Nobody will be entirely happy with an outcome. But I think if they don't, and if he pulls the five, oh my gosh.
Yeah, but it just... I'm saying that the residents have legitimate grievance over 30 years.
Yeah, and you don't said blame the residents. Is not to be trusted, which is a strong statement.
Not necessarily the GAA, but the corporate entity that is Croke Park. Mm-hmm. They don't trust him, and the basis of re-establishing the trust is in the Mulvey report. I think there is a compromise. Garth Brooks is going to announce his world tour.
Part of the problem is these are five specific Irish dates. There isn't a world tour, so they don't have as much flexibility.
But he could do the three dates as outlined and finish his world tour next spring in another two concerts for the tickets that are already sold. And I think that would be a sort of fair...
At Croke Park.
Let's bring in the rest of the panel here.
I think rather than have it like a showdown at the hoedown...
Well, you can ring Kieran Mulvey with that after the programme.
The problem is, in the locals' eyes, the GAA, the Croke Park, keep shifting the goalposts to suit themselves. And the report, if people were given enough time, which they haven't, this report, as I said, was only out last week. Some people haven't read it. Some people don't understand that the Croke Villas, which is a Corporation Council flats, Croke Park is now saying they'd regenerate it, opened by Princess Grace in the early 80s. And it'll be good if the area was considered as an area.
I think everyone can see a lovely horizon. It's the whole how to get from here to there question. And Cathy Sheridan, I mean,
respect Owen Keegan, and trust is the way.
Well, Owen Keegan is there on the front of the Sunday Independent today, and a lot of talk about him. And it seems we have these rules and regulations where a city manager's decision can't be overturned and all that kind of stuff. What do you make of it?
Well, what I make of it is that it goes back to the story of the scorpion and the frog. The scorpion depended on the frog to get him across the river, or they both would die if the scorpion stung the frog. Mm. The scorpion stings the frog, because that's what the scorpion does. It's in my nature. That's what promoters do, it's what bankers do, it's what developers do. And that's why we have regulators, why we have very highly paid officials to regulate these matters, to look at planning laws, to look out for us, the people who bought the tickets as gifts, who are travelling from Australia, whatever. What I'm very struck by is the main reasons the Dublin City Council decided against this was the number of proposed concerts and the impact on local residents. Now, this was staring them in the face last February. Yet, all of this went ahead without a single public warning from any agency to the effect keep your money in your pockets. This is by no means a foregone conclusion. And the reason that didn't happen is because this has been going on and on and on since that plan, since the original act came into force. It's been going on for decades. And that's why Peter Egan sounds stunned. It's why Garth Brooks sounds as though he has no brain. It's why a lot of people involved need a smack. There's a lot of people in this case need a smack. And also, there's the undeniable fact, as Kieran Mulvey referred to there, that there are forces at work among the protesters around Croke Park who really haven't their eye on the Garth Brooks concerts. It's about using the Garth Brooks concerts as a way of drawing attention to their own particular local problem. Now, why Dublin City Council could not have taken that, factored it into their decision, got involved in this marvellous report that Mick refers to, and used that in the decision they finally came to. For all the sneering that goes on about Garth Brooks and his music, including in my own papers, one anonymous referred to his music yesterday as mediocre ballads, I will hunt that person down next week. Because he's responsible for at least two great songs. Two. I don't know any more, to be honest with you, but I will say that for the man. It's more than I know about One Direction, for example. But nonetheless, there is all of this going on while Dublin City Council says they reach a decision a few weeks before an event and then say, sorry, the law says we can't change it. What sort of management is
that? But John Fitzgerald, we seem to be particularly good in this country at tying ourselves up in these Gulliver's Travel kinds of farcical knots about something that should have been, as Cathy said, very straightforward and quite simply managed. How do we manage to do this?
Well, I think it'll be interesting to revisit this next year and see whether we've learned from, all right, there's a mess. I think Kieran Mulvey seems to show the way through, the way out of this. I'm not sure what the end of this, it's not going to be a happy ending, but it's, are we still in this place next year and the year after? I think we need to sort it out. The other thing is, I think that anybody who has bought a house since Croke Park was built must have known they were buying a house beside Croke Park. So that the idea that you can veto anything that happens there, you have, if it devalues your house, you've got the house cheaper because it's your next Croke Park. So I think that there needs to be compromise on both sides, but it really, it looks to me as if living near Croke Park, that not enough consideration has been given to residents when events are on. They need to be given priority and looked after when the events are on. So yeah, we could do better.
You a fan?
No.
All right, so you won't be going.
But I hope the report, you see, the Croke Park have committed themselves to this report, that they publicly stated it, and it, you know, that if now they don't get their way, that they then relinquish their corporate responsibility.
That's a key thing, because like Crokevillas, for example, which is a long-running issue and we've been involved in trying to get investment in that area, that's 11 million euro of investment. There's half a million euro fund for the local community as a result of this here, and there was compromises in the years afterwards. I personally believe that Owen Keegan should have taken that report on board. The application, the planning application, was actually granted. It was the conditions of the application which says that it limits it from 5 to 3. This report was the substance to say that that condition shouldn't have been, because we now, as Kieran Mulvey said, and speaking to yourself, Anya, that should have been registered. That agreement should have been registered as one of the conditions of the 5 concerts going ahead. That was the proposal. The councillors, up until the 1st of June, had the ability to reverse this decision, but as a result of a statute instrument that was signed, no councillor now, or no elected councillors, can actually reverse a planning decision by an executive in the planning authority.
Yeah, that's the situation.
But hopefully, because of, and hopefully we do get unanimous support tomorrow at the council meeting, that it will put more pressure on the CEO to act creatively, as Mulvey has requested.
The city manager revisits the issue in the light of the recommendations in this report.
Yeah. Okay. But there's only 24 hours. I mean, that was quite, you know, that he just said there's not
Kieran
even 48 hours.
Kieran did say it was the shorter time frame rather than the long. So let's wish him well on that. Park that one for the moment, and let's hope it comes to a happy solution, possibly with a dollop of leadership and perhaps some cash on the table. Let's talk about the other story of the week. Leadership and cash actually come into this as well, because you're talking about the change of leadership at the top of the Labour Party and the cash business being the row that's now going to happen in the light of the reshuffle over the budget between Fine Gael and Labour. John Fitzgerald, I mean, a lot of talk about change and all the rest, but the sums stay the same, don't they?
Yeah, I would be concerned that the idea that
policy was wrong and we're going to change policy. The policy is the same policy. Which
austerity, you mean?
Well, it's the how we end austerity. We're coming to the end of it. And the next budget, I think they should be looking for 2 billion. But come September, if things are going the way they are, it could be a billion or possibly even less. But I think that looking back on it, a lot of people recommend it. Delay doing things, delay austerity, take it easy. And that was sort of Labour Party policy. They wanted another year. The trade unions, they push this out in the future. Actually, now that we're almost done, it would have been better to have done it more up front. If the first year in 2011, the government had had a much tougher budget, we suggested that for the budget for this year, that they do more, which would have meant that maybe they were would be doing nothing. That coming to the end of a government in the last 2 years, it's difficult to do the right thing.
Saying that to politicians, isn't that like asking turkeys to vote for Christmas? Because they've all seen what happened in the European and local elections, and they all know perfectly well there are no votes in imposing more austerity on people. Quite the opposite.
Yeah, we have had to get out of this mess. And we're now seeing an end of it with a very substantial growth in employment. One of the problems, or one of the advantages, or one of the successes, is the policy of both the previous government in this last year and the current government has been to favour employment, and that is successful. But the benefits of the recovery are being seen by the 100,000 people approximately who've got jobs in the last 2 years, so they're better off. But the other 4 million are not better off, they're slightly worse off. So I think people are cross, they don't see the recovery. Mm-hmm. I think it is right that we've prioritised employment. I think hopefully we'll continue to see good growth in employment this year, but it's going to be 2016 probably before the population as a whole see an improvement of their living standards.
And presumably so it's the government is hoping for a political dividend before that. And one of the issues in terms of, you know, how do you make people feel better, that 4 million, Michael Noonan was highlighting during the week, Pearce, and Joan Burton even agreed with him about it yesterday, was the guard and the nurse on more than 100,000 who are struggling in cash terms because of their mortgage and their payments and all the rest. And people like that afraid that if Sinn Féin comes in with its wealth taxes on anyone over 100,000, that those people are going to be worse off, are they?
Well, first of all, the question, this all arose as in relation to a question of whether we should apply additional taxes on those individual incomes above 100,000. I find it hard to find...
Not joint household incomes.
The proposal is always on individual income. So I would find it very hard to find a Garda or a nurse that's earning above 100,000. They simply, you know, the majority of Garda and nurses don't earn that type of money unless you're maybe the chief commissioner or so on and so forth. So the analogy or the examples that were given by both ministers are simply wrong. If there are individuals who individually have an income of over 100,000, which means they have a joint income of 200,000, that they're suffering, there may be. They may have bought an absolute mansion, they may be in serious mortgage distress and so on and so forth, but it is my contention that they can deal with the burden of reducing the deficit more than somebody on middle income or low income. And politics is all about choices. I disagree with what John Fitzgerald said in there, that we should have done this faster. Like every single growth prediction that the government had predicted, and indeed the SRI, hasn't materialised. The type of growth that we were supposed to see this year, last year and so on, did not materialise because we dampened consumer demand.
But the type of default that you were advocating, you look at Argentina and they're being chased by the hedge funds through the courts now, because it seems in this world you can't get away with default. There is a price to pay.
Well, first of all, Argentina had had a national default. Sinn Féin haven't called on that. What we asked for was that we would default on the banking debt. And Ireland actually did default on some of the banking debt in terms of subordinate debt. Greece defaulted on a lot more than banking debt, and they actually have seen their bond rates decrease more rapidly than indeed Ireland. So the idea of defaulting on banking debt that was never taken out of the Irish state isn't comparable to what Argentina has. And indeed, if we're to believe Michael Noonan, he wanted to default in more of the debt, but wasn't allowed to by the ECB. And others, commentators, including myself, believe that we should have went ahead and done that, and we should have stood up to the ECB. And indeed, you hear people from the IMF and others who are now retired saying that we should have taken other courses of action.
There is an issue, Mairead McGuinness, that's increasingly being discussed, not just in Ireland, but internationally. And this is the issue of wealth inequality. And it's one of the things that's, you know, bothering people. You say, John Fitzgerald, you know, that the 4 million people aren't feeling better off. But there is a section within the population that is very definitely feeling better off. And it's the widening gap between them and everybody else, you know, that politicians around the world are increasingly concerned about, and a feeling that we in Ireland need to rebalance.
Yeah, Christine Lagarde of the IMF, she's been saying this quite clearly, that it's not good, it's not healthy for economies, it's not good for people that there is such wealth inequality. I did read an article recently, but I haven't got the figures, John, you might be more expert on this, where it said that in Ireland, the level of inequality was not as severe as in other places. You might reference that for me.
But actually, Ireland is a more equal society today than it was before the boom, because so many of the really rich have been wiped out. That income,
there's much more poverty.
For those earning over 100,000 a year, the total income above that is down about 24%, whereas it's down 13% for below that. So that it is made, we're not happier for being a more equal society. And it doesn't mean that you couldn't take more from those over 100,000, as Piers suggests, in that I think that more could be done. But the way the adjustment has been done in Ireland, there's been a huge increase in expenditure on social welfare. Not the rates are not generous, but the state has had to deal with the unemployed. And it goes back to the issue that people who are really better off today are the people who've got jobs who didn't.
Yeah, just on the general point, though, of reshuffles and economy and budgets. I mean, Jim Power has an interesting piece. I don't know if you read it on page 2 of the Sunday Business Post. And his conclusions are that for the next year, it could rather comfortably come in under 3%. So while we'll continue to debate this 2 billion, we could still achieve the targets with less than half of that adjustment. So even though we're having this discussion and the Taoiseach and New Taoiseach will meet tomorrow on this issue, there is room, and the Minister for Finance, Michael Noonan, has said there is room to perhaps give some comfort and support to those families who do not feel better off. I mean, I met them on the campaign.
Yeah, but you start looking
counties.
At the tax system and you start looking at the cost of any significant tax change, and it runs into billions pretty quickly, doesn't it, John?
Yeah, I mean, of course, but I still think, I mean, on
the
campaign...
Well, he doesn't have billions to pay with unless he robs Peter to pay Paul.
We don't have billions to pay with. But if you look at the economic indicators, the recent figures show that we are on the right track. So that is positive. Where I think there is a gap is between the sense that people are weary of all of the burden they have
too
carried. And we heard that on the campaign, and they want to see light at the end of the tunnel. But last point on this about growth. We had Renzi, the Italian Prime Minister, in the European Parliament this week, and he said, we have the stability, but we need the growth. In Ireland, we have some growth. We need Europe
to
grow.
But he's the latest to argue with the ECB. I want to ask you one thing, because there's two names going to Europe, not just Phil Hogan's. Well, we don't know that it's going to be Phil Hogan's. It could be Eamon Gilmore's. But that, however many names there will be one woman's. And the speculation is that you will be the woman's name that will go forward as Ireland's potential nominee for the commissioner's job. Is that your understanding?
I haven't had a phone call, so if my name is on a piece of paper, I'd be very pleased if it was on a piece of paper. I'd hope it would be more than just because I'm a woman. I do think that the job of commissioner is an important one. I believe it will be Phil Hogan. I think that's always been the discussion around the table, and it's the Taoiseach will decide. But I do know in the last commission that President Barroso specifically requested that member states put forward a commission that would have gender balance in it. And it's a very big issue at a European Union level.
So you could be the winner on gender terms if your name is on that piece of paper.
Anya, really. I think it's unfair, John. Thank you for that. Look, I mean, all of these things, like all political speculation, I used to love it when I was in the media. I'm not so sure now, but...
I see Dan O'Brien. Ryan is suggesting Lucinda Creighton as an alternative to Phil Hogan. Can I just say, I think it's an absolute scandal that the issue of commissioner has just been decided quietly as part of some kind of low-level trading deal
years ago. I mean, Dan O'Brien makes the point that this we're talking about here is something akin to a federal European government with very considerable powers. And yet it's become a sort of, well, as we know, a retirement ground for politicians who haven't become too popular.
Well, there is a lot of politics in it, though. There is a lot of trading between countries over the whole
thing. No, I'm talking about our choice of
the way we do it here.
The way we choose commissioner. I'm not saying we're that much different to other countries.
No, we're not.
Make them then, John.
No, just when I... This sort of debate, you know, about what the Labour Party should have done and how who's been affected most and worse but by the bank crisis. I always think of a conversation that occurred between the great Republican Socialist, Padraig O'Donnell, and Eamon de Valera when both of them were old men. And Padraig O'Donnell said to Eamon de Valera, "You must feel ashamed of yourself that under your watch a million people emigrated." And Eamon de Valera said to Padraig O'Donnell, "But Padder, under your watch, a million people would have emigrated." And Padder said, "Yes, but it would have been a different million people." And that's the issue that faced the Labour Party. Historically, they're the working class party, the party of looking at need, the party of socialism. Now, I didn't hear the word socialism mentioned by any of the two contenders. Or, you know, that what is the alternative system to the boom and bust that is capitalism? What is the alternative?
Yeah, it's true, Mick. Even Mark Carney, the governor of the Bank of England, has made this point. The same one as Christine Lagarde. Yeah. There is actually a very fundamental questioning of the capitalist system, and it's a great time to take it on.
But or Joan Burton have this debate?
Well, I kind of admire Joan Burton for making her priority the working poor, which I think is our greatest living scandal in this country.
Well, no, what you're saying is she wants to incentivise people on social welfare to go back to work, but there is no work.
Well, no, her main thing is the working poor. Isn't that her priority?
Well, I appreciate that, and I know that is a
scandal. Yeah. I've talked to some people.
You raise a question there that Piers Doherty is very interesting, because, you know, you can run around in opposition and you can say, you know, we'll bring in the wealth tax and we'll do this, that and the other, and we can find the money elsewhere so we can, you know, not inflict so much austerity, and we have the alternative. But you know right well, if Sinn Féin ever does sit down on those government seats, the first thing the civil servants will be saying to you, "Oh, as minister, you can't do that." And the ECB will be on the phone and saying, "Oh, no, minister, you definitely can't do that, or else we're going to shut down the whole operation." So, that you know, it's all very well somebody within a small Irish party saying, "We have the alternative." You get the power and you don't have that alternative because the markets and the international institutions won't give it to you.
Well, and you mentioned the civil service, and, you know, people call it the permanent government. We are in government in the north. Obviously, there's lots of restrictions in terms of fiscal and so on and so forth. But and civil servants would have said to ministers who went in, for example, Conor Murphy, who went in the first assembly and said he's stopping in its way, he's stopping water charges being imposed on the Irish people, even though contracts were signed, water meters were about to be rolled out. Civil servants says he can't do that, but he says, "I am the boss, I'm the minister, I'm the directly elected minister." And I think we lack some of that in our departments. You see it very clearly in some of the government ministers which lead their departments, and you see others which follow. And hopefully, if Sinn Féin are in a position of government...
Who are the good government ministers who lead?
It doesn't necessarily mean to say that they're good government ministers, but like, for example,
who are the ministers who show leadership?
They led their department. Alan Shatter was one. Like, there's without a doubt, Alan Shatter led his department. Now, that's not making a judgment whether he led it right or wrong, but he led his department. Others follow their department and follow the civil servants. And it wouldn't matter which type of government you had elected, because really it's the civil servants that are dictating the pace. So I would like to believe, and I hope that we have the opportunity at some stage to show that we are different and that we will lead the departments that we are elected to, that we're not going to go into government, as I said before, to be in government. We're going to go in to bring about change. And that's, I know probably every party will say the same thing, but I'm genuinely, as somebody in the leadership of the party, committed to that there, and wouldn't be part and parcel of entering into government unless we believe that we could bring about the change that we're talking about.
But look at what's happening at the moment. In the midst of all this austerity, we have a property bubble developing in Dublin. What created the situation in the first place was an incredible demand for property. The banks pouring money in and property just going up to absurd levels, you know, to the point that loads of people who bought during that time are in negative equity and are some of them losing their houses. Now, I mean, what I mean by even under the capitalist system, you can have a social democratic regulation. The Kennedy Report.
But most people
40
aren't
years.
Worried about capitalism, Mick. What they're worried about is can they afford a home or not? And I remember you, John Fitzgerald, at the start of this crisis, saying that there were, you know, the young people working for Google, and there were people in the centre, people around the place who had money, who had jobs, who weren't buying houses because they were waiting until the market bottomed out. And you said you'd know we were on the way back when they started buying again. I've heard people in that category saying they can't buy at the moment because actually the prices are going so far up again, there's no value.
It's not a problem. What's happened in Ireland is there are 100,000 more people employed. There are an awful lot of people, basically people under 35, didn't buy because they were either too young or too wise. And an awful lot of them have some savings, and now they would like to move on, move out from home. And we're not building anything. So until we start building, there's going to be a problem. And going back to what Mick said about Pat O'Donnell, it's a different 100,000 that we have.
A different million, actually.
Give or take.
Yeah. Public policy is faced with a problem where there's a shortage of dwellings at current prices, and you can reallocate by spending more on rent supplement because there are people at the bottom who really need to be accommodated. The answer is going to be to build more, and it's public policy should address why are we not building more and how can we build more quite rapidly. And I see there are stories in the papers today and yesterday about NAMA playing a significant role in this, and I think the editorial, is it in the Business Post today, is on how NAMA may be shut down. That I think we need to look at the policy of how we're going to build more.
I think the problem, and I was looking at a tweet that PJ Gallagher, the comedian, tweeted yesterday, and it was an image. You can see the picture. Just it was 60 people queuing to purchase an unfinished house in Dublin, and he says, "Welcome the boom times again." Yeah, or you know, it was like a scene from Back to the Future. The problem, and I find this just amazing, that we now have government talking about a crisis in housing, that we now have issues like NAMA and the Strategic Investment Fund being talking about looking at building houses. It's going to be at least 2 years before that comes on online. Like, we have a crisis that should have been addressed 3 years ago.
One of the problems in the housing market, of course, is that there's a whole load of people who would be buying and selling normally. They would be moving on from the apartments they bought 5 or 6 years ago, who are stuck because of the whole banking situation and negative. Is there anything that can be done about that? Because that could have an impact on the market a lot quicker than building is going to be able to have, couldn't it?
Yeah, like the big fear, and banks are starting to move in relation to allowing people to move out of houses that either they want to trade up or trade down, and obviously mostly elderly people who might want to trade down, that they would be in fear of losing their tracker mortgages. AIB, for example, has come out with a product just this month, the last week, in relation to keeping the tracker. So those parts are all part of the solution. The big problem here is that you have an escalating house prices in Dublin that's going to filter into the rest of the country at a time when there isn't enough supply of credit. If supply of credit comes on board, if the banks start lending, that is going to increase quite substantially
Eddie
again.
Eddie Hobbs is right.
And then you're back into a whole circle.
Because there isn't enough credit.
But what I'm suggesting is that the conditions that led to the previous bubble are still there. And like 30 or 40 years ago, the solution came up. It was called the Kenny Report, which was regulating the price of land, that the land doesn't become in excess of its true value. And that's, you know...
Those kinds of proposals aren't just coming from the
left. That's looking at the system that creates...
I heard Lucinda Creighton talking about the German system where there's a relationship between earnings and the value of a mortgage or the value of property. And, one of the big problems here is the huge disparity between the cost of housing and the value of people's incomes.
Yeah. It's almost like we need to start again, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, the NAMA land bank, I mean, there is a shortage of supply. And that we have a problem now because we have more people at work. Now, it's good that we have more people at work, but they want to buy homes. The availability of credit is an interesting problem because I understand that there is a lot of savings and that's pushing prices. There are people with money who are buying houses because they have held back, as John has said. If you look at the rest of the country, this has not filtered out yet, and we don't want the bubble, Mick, that we've had because that has had horrendous consequences. There's only two ways of solving it: supply and demand. And the supply is short and the demand is greater than it need be.
But you said, Mairead, that people have this desire to own their own house. Mm. I mean, in the 50s and 60s, the role of the local authorities in supplying houses, and people were quite happy to rent off the council.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, your dad actually just introduced the £5,000 grant to encourage people to move out of the council houses and into private property.
I remember my dad buying one of those on a corporation loan, which was a big thing at the time.
What's wrong with public housing? Why is it considered that to be below your status to, you know, if the council, if as an emergency measure, that there was a programme of building, and not only would it be an economic...
Well, then you're back to budgets and there's the whole business of the property. I want to talk
about...
And also
the cramming of population into Dublin and its environs. Can I just say, there is a two-tier thing going on at the moment that has been ignored in this whole debate. Why are we cramming more people into Dublin? I mean, Dublin has already scooped the pool in terms of all the amenities, all the privileges of being the capital city, yet it's closing off the keys to traffic coming in, commuter traffic coming in, cars. I'm not saying I support...
You got a huge reaction to that story,
I did,
didn't
and
you?
It was mostly from cyclists who completely misunderstood my argument.
If you just explain the background.
It was Owen Keegan, as we know, whom I have no personal grudge against, whatever, but wants to implement a plan, which was not of his making, in fairness, to reduce motor traffic into the city. He has hit upon the North Keys as his particular point of interest at the moment, which would introduce two cycling lanes and reduce motor traffic down to one.
Now, there's already, for most of the time along the North Keys, there's only one lane because the other lane is a bus lane.
And
there's a turning lane for bits.
There is. For a short space, there is only one lane. My objection is not to introducing more cyclists. They are a wonderful breed. Interestingly, my own bicycle was stolen the day after I wrote that piece. I surprised people to know that I actually own a bike, but it was stolen from my yard in Ardcloch, which no one ever heard of. Anyhow, I'm not holding it against anyone, and I'm not suggesting Owen Keegan did it. But the point is, I'm not against cyclists. I am against an attitude that says, we have everything in here. We have all the services. We have the theatres, the National Gallery, all of those wonderful privileges of being the capital city. But you're not allowed in unless you're on a bicycle or unless you're prepared to use public service that is completely still inadequate. That's my problem. It's an attitude thing. It's please acknowledge there is a problem before you decide this is the way things are going to be. That's all I'm asking. I totally support cyclists and cycling lane. Can I just make that very clear?
Did you get a bike since?
No, I didn't. I'm still sort of festering a bit about losing the first one.
Listen, we leave
and
the
I'm
bike.
Wondering who
bike.
Took it.
We leave the bike and we'll take a break. Back with more after this. Welcome back. Áine Lawler here for Marion. With me in studio, Mick Rafferty, community activist, Cathy Sheridan of the Irish Times, John Fitzgerald, ESRI economist, Sinn Féin TD, Pearse Doherty, and Fine Gael, MEP and Vice President of the European Parliament, Mairead McGuinness. We've also just been joined by Declan Power, security analyst, and we hope to talk to you, Declan. We'll be getting to that whole story of spying and ISIS and the various concerning developments in the Middle East that have been going on. But I want to deal with one other concerning story that's been getting an awful lot of headlines this week, and this was the sentencing of Ralph Harris for indecent assault on a number of young women. And of course this follows Jimmy Savile, Max Clifford, Stuart Hall, and now there's talk about an inquiry into a missing dossier. And this was a dossier that was compiled by a former MP and given to Leon Britton, and it made various allegations about paedophile activity by senior figures apparently in British life, including a number of politicians. So it really does seem to be, I mean, that phase gets trotted out again and again, doesn't it, Mairead? An appalling vista.
It is. I have to be frank, I don't like reading the details of any of this. I think it's quite appalling because we've been convulsed by it here in this country. I think when you hear of figures of your own childhood past and they're now in jail, like Ralph Harris, we had no notion at the time.
And my mother loved Ralph Harris, and she'd sit there in front of the television and think he was a lovely man.
Yeah, well, you know, and enjoyed all of that. And then you hear of this deeper issue of a report that brings this to, if it is the case, to the top level. It's just quite frightening if that is the case. But, I mean, it's amazing how many of my vintage are saying, gosh, did we ever think man
it's actually
was
shocking.
It is.
You know,
yeah,
it goes beyond that sort of fright because here you have Jimmy Savile and Ralph Harris, whose trade really was entertaining kids. they adored him. Yeah. And the description
and
of...
And had access to them.
And, had access, yeah. And the description of what... And the manner in which he did it. It seems so casual. You know, did the...
And also the joy. And I mean, that would be reflected in some of the stories that came out about clerical paedophile activity here. Almost the very twisted satisfaction in doing these things in plain sight, almost in front of other people.
Yes,
the extra abuse of power.
And grooming young children.
Yeah. Mm.
But isn't it exactly as you say, a variation on what certain figures within the church did when they abused their position? And initially, any reports about it would be blown away because...
How could that be true?
You know, Father so-and-so do something like that? And what we're seeing now, it's like the next chapter unfolding in this sorry saga, where now you have the kind of secular priests, if you like, in media, as Jimmy Savile was. He was like a high priest of media, if you like, and Rolf Harris. And it is a beggar's belief in many respects. I was just saying it to Cathy there before we came on air. I can remember as a kid, I'm of an age where Rolf Harris, Jimmy Savile, these are people you grew up with who were... seen as
Gary Glitter, don't forget.
Gary Glitter.
Oh gosh,
and,
yes.
You know, the sad truth is, it's probably not finished yet. You know, there'll probably be a few more figures over the next number of years uncovered. It seems to be that there's a lot of people coming out of the woodwork now that they wouldn't have been listened to. And I suppose it's teaching us a hard lesson.
I have to say, I don't understand the drive of paedophile. You know, I don't. I mean, and you know, I understand this attraction between man and a woman and the joy that brings. And I mean, I think it's a betrayal of the most sacred trust that a man is given, to betray a child. You know, and to use your power that the child
but
is,
you talk
is
about the way we treat children. And I mean, one of the, you know, there's another story, and I don't want to go into the details because we really don't want to cause any upset to anyone's family or to any young woman. But you see stories, and they are around at the moment, and they go viral online. And a young woman is, you know, recorded doing something foolish in public, which involves a number of other men. And that young woman becomes the focus of viral attention. Yeah. And, you know, it has happened before, it will happen again. Why is there not the focus on the young men? Why is it always the poor, unfortunate young woman who finds herself? And newspapers kind of going to town on this with their head. Does that turn anyone else's stomach? Because I find that deeply uncomfortable.
Look, who hasn't done something stupid at the age of 19? I would hate to have had social media around when I was 18 or 19. Mm. And that's the reality. And also, I do think social media, notwithstanding what the tabloids are doing about that particular episode, Anya, there's a lot of people have ended up with stuff about them on YouTube in the last number of years. And it's an unfortunate thing. It's tough. It's tough time to be an adolescent now, where your own peers can go and make a fool out of you. And it's there. There's a record of it. But going back to a point you were making, and you were making yourself about paedophilia and some of the more sinister things that come out now. One of the things I think that's somewhat disturbing is that it's not just about paedophilia. It's about, like, Jimmy Savile exhibited tendencies that were kind of psychopathic, and so when somebody gets access to the levers, we'll say, of power through media, through social media, if they've got a number of different tendencies, it's like a playground for them. You know,
Jimmy Savile was actually accused of molesting the dead.
I know, yeah.
It just boggles the mind.
Making jewellery out of glass eyes from corpses. It's macabre. I mean, Dickens.
Yeah, and the truth is, like, people did know. No more than in Ireland, in certain cases, people did know, but there was a silence because while we're appalled now, there was also a sense, I think, that, gosh, if we say anything, this would really shake society. And, because it's a priest or it's a media person, whatever, now it's all open, and that's very, very good. But I'm also minded to the reality that a great deal of abuse of children is not outside. It can happen within families. So sometimes it's easier for us as a society to think it's some evil stranger or Jimmy Savile.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's other issues as well around it. And in a way, when I say I don't read the detail, perhaps I should, but I just find it
It is in the end
disturbing.
All about, in the end, isn't it? It's about giving young people the confidence to blow the whistle, to call for help, and the confidence to say stop.
The power that they have a right to speak out where they feel uncomfortable, that you should not, even where there's verbal abuse, and sometimes I even think in media sometimes there's a great deal of verbal abuse, that people sometimes should say, stop, it's not acceptable.
But sexual
abuse is definitely
I think the first thing is to accept that there are men like that, And there are men like that who get themselves into positions where they are have access to children. Yeah, and it's not just a casual thing. Like, this is wherever did
oh, look,
the
it's
nature...
A, it's every parent's, really is it's every a parent's nightmare. Yes. Anyhow, it is midday, so we have the news summary now from Susan Jackson. Susan, thank you very much indeed. And actually, just listening there in the headlines, talking about stuff going viral, of course, that footage of the Israeli army and the beating of that teenager is something that's getting an awful lot of attention around the Middle East. And this, of course, follows claims that the young dead Palestinian, who apparently was related to this teenager who was beaten up apparently in this footage by, it appears, Israeli security forces, the teenager beaten up has American citizenship, so it's getting a lot of attention there. Claims that the young teenager who died, that the body had been burned and so on, and we don't know what happened there. And then, of course, that followed the abduction of the three young Israelis. And all of this in the context where this group, ISIS, which seems to make Al-Qaeda look tame, where they're making huge strides throughout Iraq and Syria. And again, another video, because the online world feeds all of this conflict so much. We had this character, al-Baghdadi, giving a sermon in the mosque in Mosul during on Friday, which is regarded as very significant, a very holy site, and in another call to jihad and what appears to be a really nasty sectarian conflict brewing throughout the Middle East now between Sunni and Shia, and all kinds of claims of atrocities either way. So... Declan Power, the only thing you can say is it looks as if there are so many fires burning in different places throughout the Middle East, it's going to turn into one almighty conflagration.
Yeah, it's hard to talk about this without kind of coming out of things that sound like banal kind of general statements. But the truth of the matter is that this is just, it's the next chapter, the next phase of something that was always going to unfold unless the root causes were dealt with. Like, you're quite right, ISIS are really kind of the next level of Al-Qaeda. They're just Al-Qaeda under new management, a new franchise.
And with territory and with dollars and with weapons.
Resources. And not just, you're quite right, not just the resources, but they're coming at it from a different angle. Like, they got truly trounced, if you like, on the battlefield because their heads were cut off. You know, the Americans were quite successful against them from a military point of view. But as anyone knows, with regards to counterinsurgency, you can't beat it militarily. You can contain it. You can tamp down the fires a bit to allow the politicians and the diplomats do the essential work to try and create a peace process, if you like. We've seen this in the North. Thankfully, the North was never as bad as this. But the principles, in many respects, are the same. And unfortunately, the lessons don't get learnt. So Al-Qaeda had its head cut off, but the philosophy hadn't gone away. And then you had the conflagration in Syria, which allowed that extremist thinking flourish again under the eyes of the West. I mean, what's interesting, too, is how diminished the US intelligence gathering operation in that part of the world was, where initially the West saw the Free Syrian Army as the rebels to support. And that was true, that was fair enough. But what people weren't paying enough attention to was the conglomeration of smaller groups, extremist Islamic fundamentalist groups that were starting to grow, that were getting funded from various business personages across the Middle East, and more importantly, that were becoming attractive to young Western European Muslims who were willing to go and fight and shed their blood. Those that have survived in that are blooded. We've seen their effectiveness as a military force. You've seen the overturning, if you like, of the old Sykes-Picot agreement that created the modern Middle East. And so ISIS now are saying, not alone have we won a victory on soil here, we're saying to the Arab world in general, we have changed the map. That's very...
It's ironic in a way, isn't it, that it's happening at the time when everybody's doing all this, commemorations of 1914. Yeah. And in a way, it's that post-colonial map that's really being torn up now. But what's it going to be, what it's being replaced with looks like it's going to be messy and dreadful.
You know, if you remember Afghanistan, the Americans actually resourced the extreme Muslims to destabilize what was then a communist regime. And then when they did succeed in overthrowing that, they turned their guns against the infidels, the Americans. And the same thing, I mean, bring back Saddam Hussein. I mean, whatever we think, and Gaddafi.
But they're gone. Chapter is over
absolutely,
now, isn't it?
But you're left with the legacy of...
which could be a lot worse,
the United States and Europe... using extreme forces for their own policy gains, and but now it's come back to bite them.
Have we also learned a lesson, though, from the Egyptian thing, when Morsi?
Yes, Mohamed Morsi. Yeah.
Yeah. When he took power,
he was the Islamic. What's the name of that organization? Anyhow, Muslim it's an Islam, Brotherhood. It's Muslim Brotherhood. He was the leader.
There was a huge debate as to whether it was a coup or not, and there was a huge amount of fudging, which I understood at the time because he was seen to be overthrowing somebody who was causing serious problems.
But he was democratically elected.
He
wasn't
was. He? And are we now reaping the harvest of that? You know, I suppose what it shows is how difficult modern diplomacy is and how difficult it is to get things right. At the time, that Arab Spring seemed to be a wonderful thing to celebrate, and now it's turned into a nightmare.
We met with the Iraqi ambassador in the last month, because obviously the developments in Iraq are hugely concerning, not just to that region, but internationally. And they have the potential to cause serious problems. And one of the concerns that we would have is that the Iraqi government hasn't been as inclusive as it should be. And at the end of the day, this will only be resolved through a peace process, whether it's the Iraqi government in that formulation or some other formulation. And they need to deal with this at this point in time. And concentrating power around the Iraqi government, around a number of key individuals, has fed the issue in terms of ISIS's growth and their kind of agenda. So we'd be very concerned. Like, there's no place whatsoever for the type of sectarian extremist that ISIS is.
But talking about sectarianism, I want to talk about sectarianism a little closer to hold. I've just torn this off. I don't know, has anyone seen this on Twitter? I'll just pass it around there. It's a picture from the Bloomfield Estate in Bangor. It's a 12th bonfire that's being created. But just on that bonfire, you have a picture of the Alliance Party politician Anna Lowe and also the Sinn Féin politician Martina Anderson, and it looks as if it looks like a highly sectarian placing of their posters on this bonfire. Oh, yeah. And Mick Rafferty, you've been working with loyalists up there.
But just to link this conversation, I remember Billy Hutchinson telling me, Billy is the leader of the PUP. And he was visited by a group from Indonesia who were looking at the peace process in the north, you know, and Billy explained it. And the Indonesian delegation said, and how many ethnic minorities have you had? Do you have? And Billy said, well, it's two. And Billy said to them, how many ethnic minorities do you have? They said, 140.
but in a way, I think we laugh with nervousness. Because
Absolutely.
This ISIS situation, where I can see, I mean, I'm very nervous and worried about Northern Ireland, but at least we have a peace process.
Do we? The unionists
but
have
we don't,
walked out.
Well, yeah, but just to link, as you said, the two conversations with ISIS, I'm not sure that there's ever going to be that. They seem to be very single-minded. Mm. You mentioned the word spiritual. Sometimes when God gets involved, it can be very difficult for people to talk. Oh, yeah. I'd be really worried about that. And it will have an impact on all of us. But closer to home, yes, I would be concerned about what the unions actually mean by, I think, what word have they used in terms of
a graduated response.
I think we are all aware that the peace process is not finished. And I think this is a really big downward slide in the peace process, and it needs calm on all sides to get over the 12th. This time is always sensitive.
Is it safe to take peace for granted as the new normal here?
Oh, God, no. Not at all. Never take peace for granted anywhere. We've been talking about World War I, World War II. We dismiss the European Union. People are fed up with it. It built some sort of peace. Peace is extremely fragile everywhere. We know it on our own shores. We know it from the Middle East. But in Europe, it's also fragile. Yeah. Never take it for granted.
You're 100%. You can't take it for granted. And in a sense, that's what's happened in the Middle East. Mm. The first, regardless of what one's personal opinions might be about, we'll say, the invasion of Iraq or the different wars in Afghanistan. If you look at it dispassionately, what Mick was saying there, at the end of the first war in Afghanistan, you know, against the old communist regime, that was a success from the West's point of view, but they didn't follow through on it. For example, some of the listeners there might have seen the film Charlie Wilson's War. You might be familiar with it. And one of the points he was making towards the end of that film, he wanted to bed in the peace dividend, build schools, whatever, and kind of bring a kind of a positive Western influence to bear. And They didn't do that. The gaze was moved off. As soon as the gaze, the Western gaze, the media, the general public's awareness of the particular conflict moves, that's when things go awry. Yeah. And that's what's happened in the Middle East. Now, the one benefit we have is that in Northern Ireland, okay, things aren't perfect, but there is still an engaged process going on.
Well, then let me ask you a question here, because Newton Emerson makes a specific allegation, and then I'll come to you on this, Piers. He makes a specific claim today that one of the problems in Ardoyne, for instance, is that Sinn Féin is refusing to sit down with the loyalists and the dissident Republicans, who are also pretty influential on the ground. So as you see it, Mick, who needs to show more leadership in order to get this problem resolved?
Well, let me quote something that was in yesterday's Irish Times, an article by Dan Keenan, and he quotes a community worker who was involved in the camp up there on the Ardoyne. And let me give you a bit of time. He says, "I don't want Republicans to tolerate me. I want respect." And the issue is, can't Sinn Féin accept that the British presence in Northern Ireland is not the army, is not Westminster, it's not, it is people who've lived there for 500 more colonists who are now as much part of that landscape as themselves. And I think that's the issue. And how the particularly the loyalist community express that identity is the issue. They express it through parades and through... Now, the issue on the Ardoyne, has anybody been up around that area, the Ardoyne? Where they want to go, where the loyalist band wants to go through, is not through the Ardoyne. It's actually past shops onto the Crumlin Road to go home. Yeah. Now, the issue there is that from the loyalist point of view, they're saying that we've tried to get this band home. It's a year now.
Mick, can I just ask
It's cost
you,
10 million.
There's an every woman question about that. And I've heard this being said, that this is part of, it's only a feeder into the parade, this particular route. So would it be possible for the marchers to down their tools, so to speak, and walk through like ordinary humans?
But they have offered that. But what they're saying is the parade takes 5 minutes to pass, 5 minutes of respect. But what they're saying is, certainly there was dissidents in the Ardoyne, and they're saying that they'd get up at 6 o'clock in the morning to feel aggrieved. So that's their view of the opposition.
Comes from years of history.
There are other signs. I mean, the work that we're doing, I gave you a little booklet there. There are other signs that the loyalist working class communities in Belfast that I've seen are struggling with alternative ways of expressing that history. Yeah. Mm. There's groups like the group I work with, Heel and Ankle, which is rhyme and slang for shankle, and they're exploring drama. Their history through drama. There's a group called SASH, which is a Shankill area social.
But let me clarify what you're saying. Are you saying Sinn Féin could do more to sort all this out?
I'm saying that the seeds on the loyalist side, that it needs respect. The beginning is that...
to show that respect?
Well, I think that Sinn Féin are in a difficult position because they have their dissidents, the dissidents at the back. Mm. But the problem is on both sides, that if the moderates and the men of sense don't begin to show that respect to each other's culture, like on the Falls Road, there's a Gaeltacht, a thriving Gaeltacht in the middle of a large city. It's incredible. And on the other side, there is the seeds of getting beyond the flags or getting the flags and getting some other means of expressing the identity.
Piers, if you react to what Mick said.
Yeah, well,
then.
I think a lot of what Mick's saying is reflected in an article by Newton Emerson today, which I think is deeply unhelpful and inaccurate in relation to what's happening in North Belfast with the Ardoyne Parade. First of all, it isn't Sinn Féin that dictates the framework for engagement. It's the Parades Commission. And there are two residence groups up there. The Orange Order are dictating who speaks on behalf of the residents in an effort, in our view, to try and ensure that the parade, that the engagement doesn't happen. That's the reality. Anybody who's watched North Belfast, because this has been a flashpoint for a number of years, anybody who's watched North Belfast and been an independent observer will see Sinn Féin and her leadership figures, Gerry Kelly and others, calming tension in North Belfast, telling young people and people not so young to take it calm and calm heads. And that's been blasted across our TV screens in many years. The issue in terms of respect, of course Sinn Féin has respect for those who claim British identity.
Is it willing to sit down in a round table where the dissidents are always also represented?
Of course, we've called for individual meetings with dissidents because we believe that the only way to deal with these issues are through dialogue. The reality is, it's the Orange Order won't sit down with us, and the Orange Order want to dictate who, which residence committee represent, you know, the voices of the residents. You have to put this into context. There is 3,000 loyal parades in the north. In 2005, there was 2,120 parades in the north in 2005. Today, there is twice as much. There is 3,000 loyal parades. Now, people in Newton Emerson again say nationalists are increasing their parades. There's less than 200 nationalist parades, right? And that's all types of nationalism. In terms of the 3,000 loyalist parades, most of those pass off without a problem. If you look at Derry, which I think is a template and has been resolved many, many years ago, how a flashpoint can be actually
but
a
Belfast
regeneration.
But Belfast is still intractable.
All Belfast. Remember, there's only a handful of these parades that are problematic, and it's respect is a two-way street. You have to show respect for the residents of Ardoyne, sit down with the residents unconditionally and try and come up with a compromise.
I can't let you back in because I have to
meet everybody's needs.
I also have to say as well that the residents group Stop the Croke Park Concert Madness has been on to us to say that the moratorium idea that Kieran Mulvey has suggested actually originated with them in the first place. Actually, Mick, I will give you the last word on this very briefly, just to close this one off. Do you think enough is being done to try and sort out this summer?
You made up no turning to Croke Park.
Which do you think is more sensible?
I was telling Pierce this. We've been involved in exchanges from ex-IRA combatants from Donegal.
Go on, they're going to kill me if I don't take the
UVF. And when they get together, they do respect each other's background. Yeah, they do.
The issue here, and I'm sorry about this, the issue here is a lack of political leadership at unionist level. If you look at the picture that you passed around, Anna Lowe and Martina Anderson, his picture being burnt on a loyalist bonfire. Anna Lowe's offices were targeted a number of months ago. When dissident Republicans targeted members of the PSNI, Martin McGuinness stood shoulder to shoulder to condemn it. Peter Robinson still hasn't condemned any of the attacks on the Alliance Party. Their party was instrumental.
Everything begins with respect.
No, it's 20 past 12 and I do have to take a break because otherwise I am going to be hung, drawn and quartered. So we will go to a break.